Well, thanks to Tom and Anselm for organizing an intellectually extremely rich conference, and I might add a first for me, a conference that has managed to suspend the ontological laws of time. This is a conference that is not just on schedule, but ahead of schedule. It's simply not possible. This is in many ways a conference about historicizing. And given its subject matter, it asks for a complex, decentered, and contingent practice of historical realism. And I'll begin to demonstrate a little bit of what I mean by this. We can start with the difference between the interwar context for critical primitivism and the contemporary moment. This comparison underlies the conference design, and by making it explicit, we engage in a necessary but necessarily impossible exercise, writing histories of the present without the possibility of narrative closure, what Foucault called genealogy. This historicizing, though inconclusive, can help us to ask if there are forms of primitivism and exoticism that can be retranslated for the current conjuncture, forms similar to and different from those practiced earlier. In today's dynamic world system of cultures, simultaneously post- and neo-colonial, can we recognize forms of critical primitivism? Is that an oxymoron? Or translational exoticism? We begin then not with a clear narrative, but with a juxtaposition, comparing two historical conjunctures. The first, 1917 to 1939. The second, 1970 to wherever we are now. This periodizing is admittedly crude, but we can't think historically without cutting up the flow of time into periods. Frederick Jameson has written about this, and I'm sure you know, he basically says, if you want to historicize, you cannot not periodize. The first conjuncture I don't need to dwell on. It's what the whole conference has been about. This is a conjuncture defined by the profound shock of World War I. Freud's Civilization and Its Discontent would be an emblematic text dealing with that experience. Dada is, of course, a reaction to that descent of European high civilization into barbarism. And then the 1920s and 30s, fascism, economic depression, the possibility that capitalism really had come to an end. Nothing but crisis, crisis, crisis. Things coming apart, unstable and destructive and potentially possibly creative ways. Can surrealism be imagined outside of this moment? Certainly not in Europe. I suppose if we turn surrealism as it should be into a translation term and think of it in Latin America, it would look different. The conference's historicizing focus, with an explicit and often implicit genealogical sense of a present in crisis, this generates our retrospection. And who is this our? Who is this we doing the retrospection? Still, aren't we inside the West as it loses its former centrality, but still very, very powerful? The second period or conjuncture is the current one, and I'll say more about that. Not as neat a period as something we can call the interwar period. That just sort of falls nicely bookended by two wars. It's a natural period almost. But the present period, roughly 1917 and afterwards, well, what is that? The global 60s and their aftermath, particularly in Europe and North America. The 1970s, a date, crucial date, the end of the post-war boom, les Trente Glorieuses, the French call it, when capitalism just kept going up and up and up and up and suspended its cyclical nature for an unnatural 30-year period. To the victors go the spoils. End of the post-war boom, emergence of something called late capitalism or post-Fordism or post-modernity or globalization, or nowadays we tend to say neoliberalism. These are all periodizing labels for a new conjuncture. And these are all more or less rigorously conceived histories of capitalism. And simultaneous to those histories, resistant, discrepant histories. The post-war national liberation movements from the 1950s on. And marginal peoples moving into the center, finding voice, the performative cultural politics of identity, gender, race, sexuality, and the rest. An unfinished historical dynamic of, call it for short, decolonization, often deflected, co-opted, but never fully assimilated, never permanently subsumed in a homogeneous capitalist modernity. Heteromodernities, perhaps. I've been working in my own work with two interconnected but separable structural transformations that I think have helped me characterize the last half of the 20th century. One is decolonization or post-neo-colonization. I've already used that phrase. And the other, globalization. And both have the effect of decentering the West. Post-neo-colonialism, a structural tension, an antinomy that can't be functionally resolved. Globalization, something more than just, Western capitalism going out and spreading McDonald's restaurants all over the world. Actually, something more excessive, because the social movements, some of which I'll be talking about today, and of resistance, all use the internet, all are involved in globalization just as well as world capitalism is. So that's the 20th century, the second half of the 20th century. Are we still there? This is Stuart Hall's always changing, always reopened conjuncturalism. Where are we? Well, post-2000, perhaps something new to supplement and displace, but not to replace or transcend the stories of capitalism and decolonization I was telling you about. Bernd Scherer, in a forceful Hakabe position paper, focuses on the Mexico City Scientific Conference of 2000, when the Nobel Prize-winning atmospheric scientist Paul Crutzen, now famously, coined the term Anthropocene for our current moment in geologic Earth time. This is a periodization empirically based in the so-called great acceleration of the mid-20th century, when all the long-standing human interventions on the planet suddenly dramatically increased in intensity. Anthropocene is now a periodizing label and a temporal scale or cluster of interacting scales that brings deep time back into the foreground of our thinking. I underline for historically realist reasons, not futurist imaginings or mythic origins. Anthropocene now stands for a moment of pervasive, intractable crisis and a need to think outside the limited ethno- and species-centric temporal frames that were our common sense in the 20th century. Anselm Franke began our proceedings yesterday with a Benjaminian comment when he said that deep time flashes up in a time of crisis, as it did in the 1930s and does now. Anthropocene, however, isn't exactly a historical period, unless you could think from the Neolithic to the present it could somehow be a period. So it inevitably gets cut down to size. People think, no, it's really the Capitoline scene, for example, especially industrial capitalism. So that references a 300-year history, more or less. Or recently decolonizing or indigenous critiques of the term anthropos or in Anthropocene. The really bad damage to the planet wasn't done by humans, but by certain humans in particular power formations, most prominently imperial invasion, dispossession, primitive accumulation, and resource extraction. So the current conjuncture and sense of crisis, deepening capitalist instabilities. I've been very helped in thinking about the capitalist part of the story, the capitalism history, by the recent work of Wolfgang Streeck. In New Left Review, he wrote a piece called How Will Capitalism End? New Left Review, 2014. He has a long book, of course, too. You probably know his work. Structural sustained trends in contemporary capitalism. One, declining growth. Two, rising debt. Three, growing inequality. I have no time for all the technical details that he gets into. And these sustained trends, not reversible downturns in a cyclical story, leading to not exactly an end of capitalism, but a transformation. Not a whole new system. This is not about the revolution. But these three destabilizing trends. And also, which he does not talk about, that longer temporal scale, the sense of ecological limits, population shifts, resource wars, etc. End of capitalism? Well, you may recall the Frederick Jameson's Mo, often quoted and misquoted. It goes something like, it's from his book The Seeds of Time, 1994. The quote goes something like, it's easier for us now to imagine the end of the world, an ecological end of the world, than to imagine the end of capitalism. Well, a challenge for the political imagination. The current exhibition, Neolithic Childhood, proposes that to think and imagine outside the reified reality of capitalism or the West, we can turn to a wider, longer temporal frame. In the 1930s, the deep time of the archaeological primitive and the living non-Western primitives, l'art nègre, and so forth, the vogue for tribal arts. Translated into the now, we can think perhaps of a post-primitive, but maybe something more concretely called the indigenous. And that is my theme today will be this historical reality and emergent reality that we refer to by the phrase, by the name indigenous today. By the way, I think 20 years ago, we didn't use it this way at all. I mean, if you looked up the indigenous in a dictionary 30 years ago, you'd probably get plants. You would not get a globally articulated world of social movements, of people usually in settler colonial situations, you know, kind of coming into their own in new way. You wouldn't get that. I've talked about that, this emergence, as under the phrase, I use the phrase sometimes, présence indigène, referring the negritude présence africaine of the early 1950s when Africans came out into what Marx liked to call the world stage, a certain performative existence beyond the local. Indigeneity has emerged from the deep archaism of the primitive to occupy a place of what I think of as an alter historical realism, a longue durée that both precedes and potentially exceeds the narrative times of the West, of capital, even of technology. It precedes and exceeds, but is not some disconnected outside to these potent forces. The emergence of indigeneity in its contemporary senses is the work of the 1970s, and I think especially the 1980s and 90s, a complex local global formation or assemblage that is a product both of decolonization and post-60s identity movements and of globalization and neoliberal or postmodern in the Harvey Jameson sense, postmodern modes of interpolation, localization, cultural commodification, heritage management, and performance. All these are part of indigenism. More on this, on indigenism and its difference from primitivism in a moment. But I'd like to show an image here of the Indian as a, and just let it sit here for a while, see if it comes up. Oh, that comes first. And that's going to come next. Here's the first image. And that's who it is. Luiseno is a tribe around Los Angeles, California. This is the Indian as specimen and cadaver, without a historical future. So at first, let me invoke the primitives, this common sense of the early 20th century, a common sense that was already coming apart, even as it exerted a potent hegemony in Western people's imaginations of where they were in time. I'm going to evoke a figure who isn't part of the exhibition's cast of characters, but who was a large influence on many in it, especially Michel Leiris. When Joseph Conrad in 1899, the turn of the millennium, famously evoked a voyage into the dark heart of Africa, he was thinking about a real time of early man. Going up that river was like traveling back to the earliest beginnings of the world, when vegetation rioted on the earth and the big trees were king. Conrad's alter ego Marlowe, as you may recall, his perceptions of Africa are enmeshed in two definitions, temporal frames, one dominant, the other emerging. He describes his progress into the interior as a reverse evolution, a voyage backwards in time. Critics of his primitivism are quick to quote this passage, and they do it with justification. The relegation of non-European peoples and places to a past time was and still is a commonplace of colonial discourse. But Marlowe presses on further, questioning the temporal distance guaranteed by the evolutionism of his time. He writes, "What thrilled you was just the thought of their humanity. Like ours, the thought of your remote kinship with this wild and passionate uproar. And why not? The mind of man is capable of anything, because everything is in it, all the past as well as all the future." This is not, I hope you'll agree with me, merely a kind of imperial universalism, but rather a decentered, disoriented subjectivity, actively listening, receptive to an otherness that it can't represent. 3 decades later, by 1930, a newly relativist anthropology, an idea of culture, or rather cultures, had emerged. Boas, Mohs, Irving Halliwell, Paul Radin's works all appear in the exhibition. This discourse, absent for Conrad in the 1890s, was available to the intellectual and artistic generation of Carl Einstein, Max Ernst, Michel Leiris, et al. Neolithic childhood would be Carl Einstein's memorable deep time phrase, evoking a phylogenetic evolution. But it's actually somewhat misleading, since his own work from the 1915 Neger Plastic Book to his unfinished handbook Der Kunst was primarily synchronic and exogenous, outward-looking and juxtapositional rather than narrative and synthetic. In Einstein's more ethnographic studies of African art, in the animal-human assemblages of Max Ernst, indeed, the whole vogue for l'art maigre, the surrealist love of Yupik masks, etc., etc., all this primitivist appropriation, and I insist, translation, referred to actual tribal peoples, understood with varying degrees of ethnological seriousness and cross-cultural engagement. I'm not suggesting, of course, a whole new relativist openness to alterity. Stereotypes and the subversion of stereotypes in avant-garde experimentation practices were occurring at the same time. To varying degrees, the surrealists and their generation historicized their desired others in ways that relied on Western-centered evolutionism. We don't need to be reminded that concepts of the primitive presumed an allochronic setup, as Johannes Fabian memorably demonstrated in the late 1970s, his book Time and the Other. The cultures in question were located in a different time, a past time. Even the society studied by a relativizing, purportedly anti-evolutionist anthropology associated with the likes of Boas, Malinowski, Mead, and Benedict were situated in an ethnographic present, so-called, a time separated from the modernizing West and going nowhere, destined to disappear, alas, in the relentless tide of progress. Are we still there? I hope not. We no longer think of these unexamined evolutionist ways, or not always, let's be modest and realistic. The failure of primitive peoples to disappear into an undifferentiated modernity has given us pause, or it should. The vanishing primitive is, of course, still a popular trope where often every few years we encounter another lost Amazonian tribe, you know, who is about to disappear and be corrupted by civilization, et cetera, et cetera. This is a famous intervention in the San Diego Museum of Natural History from 1986 called Artifact Piece by James Luna. James Luna is a wonderful tribal artist who died recently, and a lot of us are in pretty deep mourning for him, actually. Luna lay for hours as a living specimen among the usual ethnographic artifacts, and near him labels explained the marks on his body, many of them scars from drunken fights. This Indian artifact was motionless, but breathing. Perhaps he was listening to the museum visitor's comments, silently disturbing the ethnological exhibition's order. A specimen that could get up and walk out of the museum. In small display cases nearby, Luna's most important cultural artifacts were displayed. Along with feathers, a rattle, a peace pipe, visitors discovered a Jimi Hendrix record and a book by William Burroughs. After the artifact piece, James Luna did a series recently on Ishii. Ishii was the last authentic Indian in California, made famous by a book of 1960 by Theodora Kroeber, translated into German to many languages. And Ishii was enacted for the anthropologist, A.L. Kroeber, his life in the wilderness, the image of natural man. And this is James Luna's version of natural man. He's wearing the same loincloth, but as you can see, it's a little different. Or here's another damaged male body, if you like, Jimmy Durham. You probably know his work. Actually, the last time I was in this exhibition space here a few years ago, there was a Jimmy Durham installation there. I remember it was a bunch of rocks. I don't remember much else about it. Jimmy Durham, this here is the stereotypical Indian male body, exposed and ironically performed. Written on his right arm, it says, "Mr. Durham has stated that he is addicted to alcohol, nicotine, coffee, and does not sleep well." Near his open chest, it's written, "I am basically lighthearted, a bit lower, appendix scar. I have 11 houseplants, and Indian penises are unusually large and colored." We'll just leave that up for a bit. Given our current sense of an open-ended history, a time when anything can happen, in turning a return of fascism, something we thought had been definitively defeated, given the non-inevitable course of progress and modernization in a displaced, crisis-ridden capitalist world, we see more clearly, as the current exhibition's retrospection does, that the historical deep times of mid-20th century primitivisms and exoticisms were themselves complex and sometimes contradictory times. They presumed an earlier, better first stage of humanity in an evolutionist frame, but also challenged these temporal dispositions. The primitive and the exotic, for Einstein and company, were contemporary, critical tools for use now. Theirs was perhaps a kind of late or exploding evolutionism. An experiment like the journal Document, which contains a good deal of archaizing, archaeological material, is, however, primarily an exercise in synchronic juxtaposition. Modern painting, slaughterhouses, body parts, children's drawings, early modern anatomy texts, ethnographic evidence from beyond Europe. An impossible, as Lyrisse put it, assemblage, designed not to add up, but rather to destabilize and contrast, to open up the spaces of the real. And unlike the automatism and oniric researches of the official surrealism of its day, the explorations of individual unconsciousness and psyche, Document was a kind of ethnographic surrealism, and I insist on that word realism, an engagement with material cultures and embodied practices in the service, to use Einstein's language, of metamorphosis. Thinking genealogically in a presentist way about the moment of Document and all the surrounding avant-garde primitivism and exoticism, the search for other times, we find similarities and differences from our own current response to crisis, the need for exogamy and a subversion of rigid oppositions and borders. As I've already said, the presence of indigeneity in our historical moment, our displaced heteromodernity, is a critical difference. And to supplement those ravaged and abject male bodies, we'll substitute a female body, also, as with Luna, lying down and in some sense on display. This is Rebecca Belmore. It's called Fringe. It's actually it was created in 2008 by the Canadian First Nations artist, Rebecca Belmore. It was a billboard installed above the Montreal office of the Cree Grand Council. 8 foot by 24 foot color photograph appears from a distance as simply a semi-nude reclining female figure. Nearer, one sees a roughly sutured wound. Traversing the woman's exposed back. It looks like dripping blood, but on closer inspection, the blood is composed of red beads strung on white thread. A horrible gash has been closed using the traditional Anishinaabe beadwork of Belmore's tradition, mixed with visible white materials. An ironic reference, of course, to the odalisque traditions of European painting. Fringe interrupts an aesthetic gaze, or indeed any desire to make the body whole. The damage depicted here can never be completely repaired. A terrible scar remains, but the disfigurement has now become a kind of violent beauty, and the reclining figure, whose marked skin recalls James Luna's scars in Artifact Piece, is very much alive. And as Belmore had said about it, some people look at this reclining figure and think that it's a cadaver. But I look at it, and I don't see that. I see it as a wound that is on the mend. It wasn't self-inflicted, but nonetheless, it's bearable. She can sustain it. So it is a very simple scenario. She will get up and go on, but she will carry that mark with her. Is this a final refutation of primitivism? There's no going back? Yes and no. Indigenous deep times, or as I prefer in a historically realist mode, an indigenous longue durée, is something that I have spent a lot of time trying to get straight in my mind. In my book Returns, which grapples with some of these questions, I spent a lot of time worrying about a quotation from that I came across from an Aleutic elder, that is an older woman from the area of Kodiak Island in Alaska, and who is quoted as saying about her people, the time since the Russians arrived, and of course in Alaska the Russians came through first in the 18th century and with devastating consequences for the local culture, and followed then by the American Empire in the 1870s with further devastating consequences, and now an indigenous revival there, as in so many places. And Barbara Shangan says about all this, well, the time since the Russians arrived, that's the 18th century, are like one long stretch of bad weather. And like all those storms, they'll pass. Those storms will pass. What was she saying? Is she saying that we will go back, you know, to the way we were before those several hundred years of the world system passing through? No, she's not saying that, in my view. I'm interpreting. She's basically making a historical, realist statement, which is that conjunctures change, time changes, history is unfinished. We're still here. We weren't supposed to be, but we are. And there will be something after the bad weather. She doesn't say what it will be exactly. It won't be the way they were in the 18th century, but indigenous life, in this case, Aleutic indigenous life, will persist. Well, for me, I've spent a lot of time trying to think of this not as some notion of a mythic return, but as a historically realist account. She's talking about something that we would all accept as that actually happened in historical non-repeating time, the arrival of the Russians, the Americans. That's the bad weather. We know exactly what she's talking about. And how to think about that historical longue durée. And it's a characteristic of the indigenous temporality, unlike the colonial and post-colonial temporality, which is that colonialism, while it's important, is not all-dominating. It's a moment. And it's a history that reaches back to before colonization and before the arrival of the Western world system and projects also a possibility after that time. But I insist that it's a historically realist statement. It's not a notion of a kind of mythic return. It's not in the mode of return. It's in the mode of moving through and beyond. Now, the importance of ancestral places and ties of kinship, this is the deep time aspect of the indigenous temporality, including stories of mythic origin, has certainly not disappeared from indigenous cultural politics today. But they are never about some remote time, a place like Conrad's Africa that travel back to. Rather, land and ancestry are resources for survival and transformation, everyday ways of being in the present. People in tribal societies have for millennia lived responsibly, in scale with their environments. Not always, to be sure, but many still do. And I think the relevance of indigenous relations to land and place and ancestry in the new context that is indexed by that word Anthropocene is, I think, rather important and relevant to us. And without romanticizing the ecological Indian or anything like that, that sense of scale, that sense of remaining in a sort of deep contact, ancestral contact with a place is, I think, something very important as we think about how to go forward in the current, in the ruins, really, of the current moment. Anand Singh, who spoke here a little while back, you know, will talk about survival in the ruins of late capitalism and in the ruins of the extractive economic world system. And indigenism, I think, has a lot, something to teach us, something to pay attention to. And this is primitivism not as a nostalgic escape, but as a realist critique of civilization. This remains a potentially potent force today. But now primitivism becoming indigenism, exoticism becoming, I like the word exogamy from Carl Einstein because it has a kinship reference. It's about making connections outside of your family, outside of the space you're in, but social connections, real, you know, people, not collecting their art or producing images about them, but actually making social connection, making kinship. Primitivism becomes indigenism, exoticism becomes exogamy. The old stories and the histories are getting reopened and retold. In the emergence of indigenism into the context of what I call présence indigène, the key public date was 1992, and that's really retelling a 500-year history. 1492, Columbus discovered America. 1992, a global movement of protest emerged. Many indigenous societies, people identifying now as indigenous, were connecting with each other through global networks, getting together, having protest festivals, and basically saying, Columbus did not discover America. You know, that Eurocentric story makes absolutely no sense, you know, from our perspective. Really recoding and retelling the story. And all sorts of stories are getting told and retold like that. That was just a very public one. The other things that were happening about that time was Rigoberto Menchú won the Nobel Peace Prize. And you may recall Rigoberta Menchú, when she wrote her book, did it as a representative of all the poor people of Guatemala. And that was under a more or less Marxist dispensation. But in the intervening years, Rigoberta Menchú now speaks as an indigenous woman, whereas her traje really represents the indigenous. And there's a way in Latin America that the rearticulation of the popular toward the indígena is, I think, again, part of this movement of the 80s and 90s that is an important movement. How important is it? Well, you may say, these are the little people. I have friends who say that to me just to see if I have a sense of humor. You know, I mean, after all the millions of people in China, how important is this really? Well, you know, let's keep things in proportion. But the fact that all of these societies, and there are many of them, they're now identified as indigenous and are now involved in social movements that are making land claims, that are knocking on the doors of the museums, asking for access to their works. All of those things are happening today, which weren't supposed to happen, because everybody knew, all the smart people in the world knew that indigenous people would disappear. They were either going to be killed off by disease and conquest, or they were going to assimilate into non-existence. Hasn't happened. That should give us pause and maybe be a little bit of hope, gives me a little bit of hope. I'll just end now with another image of indigeneity today. I've been illustrating so far just one important aspect of indigenous performativity today, the indigenous artist. Art in indigenous societies is very much a part of social and cultural renewal. It's also part of the art markets. So we're not dealing with a separatist purism. We're dealing with differently articulated strategies. And this figure, though, of the indigenous artist, even the non-Western artist, is a figure entirely missing in the 1930s moment of Einstein and company. It's hinted at in the last part of the Neolithic childhood exhibition. Behind that, the last wall, in the section called Resistance and Lines of Flight. Afro-modernism in Paris is the topic there, particularly Tropique, L'Étudiant Noir, Césaire, the Césaires, Damas, Senghor. We've seen a little bit of that today. And the missed encounters with avant-garde thinkers and the surrealist artists. This was before the post-war alliances between Sartre and Orphée Noir, between Léris and Césaire. That comes later. But in the 30s context, the limits of Einstein's exogamy, purely formalist and textual, not coalitional and concretely articulated. We do encounter, in the last section of the exhibit, a single artist from Africa, the Malian, Kalifali Sidibe. And there's just one article in Document on a living African source of alterity. And it's an article about Sidibe, who had briefly had an exhibition in Paris. Corbusier wrote a condescending account of it, describing the work as merely naive and decorative. But Michel Harris wrote something much more engaged, with a sense of inclusion, a willingness to learn from this contemporary African artist. Sidibe's Fantastic Animals, especially, parsed by Lyris as totemism, but totemism as a serious translation term, I would say. But that's an exception, that contact in the Paris of the 1920s and 30s. It's an exception that confirms the rule of absence. This is, I wanted to have some different looking Aboriginal, indigenous artists who weren't necessarily like Luna and Belmore and Durham, part of the art world, you know, in a different but real way. Belmore and Luna were at the Venice Biennale of 2005. Durham, as you know, is, you know, kind of well known in places like, both in South America and in Europe. He's a diasporic tribal figure. He refuses to identify, to join his tribe, the Cherokee, because he doesn't like the governmentality, the bureaucratic governmentality. He doesn't think if you're a tribal member, you should have to sign up and have a certain degree of blood or something like that. He takes a hard line about that. Here we are in Western Australia, and this is was an exhibition that I came across in Sydney a couple of years ago. And I just wanted to let it register with you. These are not professional artists. They're not members of the art world. But as I'm sure you know, Aboriginal painting, which is a new technology representing old ancestral realities and especially relations to land and place, this art is... does have a life in the world of art, in the art world. It's some of it sells for very high prices. It was when it first came into view, people thought, oh, it looks like abstract expressionism. That was the sort of translation gambit. Now people are starting to realize that it's about more than form, but it's really about a very specific and deep time relation to place. But its mode of production is very different from the classic Western individualized artist. It's usually a collaborative form, as in this case, you know, where a community or a clan or sometimes more than one clan negotiate the process of creating the single work of art, which is really about a image of landscape and ancestral places. Now, the art can be displayed on a wall and look essentially like what we expect painting to look like and be in a museum. But it can also, as in the exhibit that I went to, be shown flat on the floor. And looking at art, I always sort of would imagine, what would Rembrandt's Night Watch look like? It's another big painting. If it were flat on the floor, that would be interesting, wouldn't it? But this is a different... relation to the aesthetic and to the visual. So to conclude, indigeneity brings a heterogeneous sense of modernity. Indigenous time is both very old and quite new, both residual and emergent, to use Raymond Williams' language. Challenging, synchronic, and classificatory anthropological ideas of culture. What's happening is both a deep continuity with ancestors and places and a critical engagement with contemporary forces. Still very useful, I think, today, Einstein's realism of metamorphosis, what's happening, the emergent making-remaking processes, the future. Not the real as what is, already is, or was, not something objective, visualizable from a coherent perspective, a subject position, even one temporally complex like a statue that you can walk around and see from all sides and thus in that way achieve totality. Einstein critiqued that whole Rodin-esque sense of the whole, but rather a constant making and remaking of forms. Indigenism versus primitivism. I insist that indigenism is fully historical, a deep history of survival and change, and a counter history to modernity or postmodernity, a longue durée, not a primitive or not a mythic source or origin. So in the end, historical realism today, I've tried to just give a little sense of it in this. If I were to elaborate this talk, I would fill in a lot of blanks and try to connect a lot of dots. Realism today needs to tell multiple stories at the same time, at different temporal scales, histories that connect but don't add up, and to be realistic today, to produce realism today, you must always, in my view, tell more than one story. If you tell only one story, that's religion, that's ideology. Realism is about stories that make trouble for each other, that overlap, that connect, but also make trouble for each other. I learned that from Gayatri Spivak, who said, you know, she always works with Marxism, deconstruction, and feminism, right? Is that the three? And the idea is not that they would all add up to a picture, but they would bring each other to crisis. They'd make trouble for each other. That, to me, that feels like the real to me. And I think, so my realism will be multiple stories. Today, I talked about capitalism. I've talked about decolonization and neocolonization. I've talked about the Anthropocene and threading through and outside, inside and outside all that, indigenous survival and heteromodernity. Those are all connected but separable stories, and I think that I'm not saying they're the only stories. They're the ones that I've worked with today, and that those are already plenty of balls to juggle. But I just wanted to leave you with my sense of the kind of what I think of as the methodology of realism today, in a displaced and indeterminate moment of crisis, in a Western context that can no longer think of itself in a kind of Hegelian way of gathering up all the world and producing a totality with, you know, even an open-ended one with Minerva's owl at the end. And that's just off the table now. So this is what I'm giving to you as an alternative. Thanks.